The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Leonetti Confetti, celebratory confetti supporting women in recovery. Learn more at leonetticonfetti.com. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hello again, everyone. Renee Powers here, and we are on our final interview episode of 2019. In the words of Jonathan Van Ness, can you even believe? I will have a bonus episode for you in a few days with my top books of 2019, but then we'll be taking a couple of weeks off for the holidays. Our first episode of 2020 will be available on January 9th, and we are chatting with Jeannie Venasco, author of Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl, and you won't want to miss that chat. Today's episode, though, features a conversation with the inimitable Grace Tillousen about her memoir, The Body Papers. This book, it's so good. It's about immigration, poetry, healthcare, feminism, so much more. Stay tuned for that interview coming up, but first, a few announcements. Grace's book was actually on our shortlist for our Feminist Book Club January Book of the Month. We're trying something new this year. As you know, our members suggest the titles that they want to read, and then we vote on them to select which books comes in their next Feminist Book Club box. We are now curating themed lists of books based on those members' suggestions. We've been brainstorming themes. We will still take suggestions for those themes. January's theme is immigration, and we are delighted to be reading together The Girl Who Smiled Beads, A Story of War and What Comes After by Clementine Wamaria. If you would like to join us, there is plenty of time to subscribe. All of that information is in the show notes as always. Last week, we told you that our subscribers will receive a window cling from All Are Welcome Here, and get excited, in addition to the book, the beautiful book, the rainbow cling, and perhaps some other fantastic edible and reusable goodies. Subscribers will also receive some celebratory confetti from Leonetti Confetti. I am so excited to tell you more about this company. Okay, founder Kylie is one of the masterminds behind our Welcoming 2020 initiative, which we're working together to create and foster a more welcoming world. So she does this through empowering and employing women in treatment. There is no cause worth celebrating more than women rising from the ashes of addiction and into a fresh start. Just like a new year, right? Kylie's company partners with Wayside Recovery Center in Minnesota to provide employment experience. So when you place an order at leonetticonfetti.com, you're making an impact in the lives of these women. Book club members will receive Leonetti Confetti in custom Feminist Book Club colors to help them celebrate and ring in the new year. As you know, we donate 5% of our sales to a different feminist cause each month. Our January charity is Welcoming America. Welcoming America leads a movement of inclusive communities becoming more prosperous by making everyone feel like they belong. They believe that all people, including immigrants, are valued contributors who are vital to the success of our communities and shared future. As you can see, their mission is absolutely aligned with our own 2020 initiative to be more welcoming by celebrating and amplifying acts of kindness and inclusion. You can learn more about this wonderful organization at welcomingamerica.org. And be sure to check out our shop to be part of our book club in 2020. Gift subscriptions are still available. If you have waited until the last minute, we got you. Just head over to feministbookclub.com/shop, purchase a 3, 6, or 1 year subscription for your friend or for yourself, and we will ship that out the first week of January. Now, let's welcome today's guest, Grace Tillousen.
Hello,
Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm sitting down with Grace Talusan, the author of The Body Papers. Grace was born in the Philippines and raised in New England. She graduated from Tufts University and the MFA program in writing at UC Irvine. She's the recipient of a U.S. Fulbright Fellowship to the Philippines and an Artist Fellowship Award from the Massachusetts Cultural Council. She's the Fannie Hurst Writer in Residence at Brandeis University for 2019 to 2021. Welcome, Grace.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I am so moved by your book, and I want to get into that. I do want to tell our readers just a quick trigger warning. We may get into discussions of sexual assault and child abuse and possibly even some immigration trauma. So just a heads up to readers there or to listeners there. But before we get started, I ask everybody, what is your definition of feminism?
My definition of feminism is it's a belief and a set of practices in which we try to give women and women identifying people equal access and opportunities and rights as men. I mean, everyone should have the same rights and access and opportunities. And that should be at the core of our belief systems. And I don't know why it's even a question, but I do know that my very earliest lessons like or around feminism is that it was a bad thing. And guess who taught this to me? Like boys and men. Like I remember hearing and seeing the looks on their faces when the word feminist would come up, and it was such an angry, kind of like disdainful look that it made me think that feminism was something bad. And it took me a while to want to label or identify as a feminist because, of course, I wanted approval as a small girl and teenager from people, and I didn't understand, like, at its very basic core, it's just equal access and opportunities. Like, why wouldn't anybody be on board with that?
Yeah, because it's threatening, right? It's threatening to the status quo. And so, yeah, when people feel threatened, they want to shut other people down. But how does that kind of yearning for equality and access, how does that inform your writing then?
Well, so a lot of the things that are in the body papers are stories, thoughts, beliefs that I think are in line with feminism and also goes against the project of silencing women and wanting us to just to smile and like say everything's okay and make things really easy, smooth things over for people. Like all the things I write about are probably the things that make things hard or challenge our notions about family, marriage, relationships, what it means to be a good immigrant. I mean, it is in some ways easy for everybody if we just smile and say everything's fine. But to contend with the complexity of what people are actually feeling and the pain people have, isolation, depression, discomfort, I mean, anything on that spectrum, to speak up and say, no, I don't want everything just to keep going and to smile and say everything's fine. That to me does feel like a feminist project to interrupt the social norms of just like saying, oh no, it's okay, I'm fine. No, I'm not fine. I was not fine. But pretending I was, suppressing like my needs for someone else's, usually a man, more powerful man in my family, was so bad for me to the point where if I hadn't gotten help and tried to heal around it, I can't even imagine what kind of life would be possible for me. Mm-hmm. And so it's been incredibly important for me to start to listen to myself, like, what do I need? What do I want? And everyone should do that. But I think I was not socialized to do that, to ask myself, what do I want? What do I need? How do I center myself and my voice? And that doing that is not antithetical to having, you know, being in the world. Like, it's like we don't have to sacrifice our voice for, you know, to make other people comfortable. Mm-hmm. We can still say what we need and like things can still proceed smoothly. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it with friends who are really intentional. Like they'll negotiate, these are sort of minor things, but I appreciate their process. They'll negotiate things and say like, you know, well, I'd like to do this. Well, the other person say, well, I'd like to do that. And then they'll say, well, how much, you know, what percentage do you really want to do this? I don't know. There's ways for people to express what they need and want and respect other people and step up and step back. I mean, it's possible. It's not just like smile and let someone else get whatever they want all the time and then they'll love you more for it.
Right. Sure, it's possible, but if you're not taught or shown a model of that, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Absolutely.
So the Body Papers, first off, brilliant title. And I know in your acknowledgments and in notes, there's a little bit of you acknowledge somebody for saying it was all her idea after she read the book. But tell me why this title, and then we're going to get into a little bit of the stories behind it too.
Sure. So yes, I you know, acknowledge my friend Joanne Diaz, the poet, for coming up with the brilliant title. And once she said it and kind of pitched the idea to me for my own book about my own work, it totally made sense. And I could see it in a way that I had not been able to. And I want to acknowledge her because I think that that's another thing that's a feminist project, which is like so many women have been supporters. And so many women have been part of men's projects and just like are not acknowledged. But so anyways, I do acknowledge Joanne Diaz for that. And the more I thought about the title and the project of my book, the more I was sold on it, because so many of our lived experiences are tied to documents. You know, we get test results, we have a piece of paper that allows us to cross a border or not. We have report cards and graduation certificates that let us pass go and move on to the rest of our life or not. There's just so many ways that our lives are really impacted by documents. And of course, it's called papers, but these are like electronic papers. I grew up in the time where they were like papers, but now they're sort of different, but still as impactful, all these kinds of documents. And also photographs are part of these papers. We don't print photos as much, but there was a time where like that's how you saw a photograph for the first time that you took was like printed out or processed. And so that's part of these papers as well. And those photographs were very important to me as I was making the book, because they gave me incontrovertible evidence that I could not dismiss what had happened to me as a child. I would want to believe like, oh, I'm fine, I'm doing well. Like, let's just kind of shut the door on the 7 years of childhood sexual abuse that happened to me. And like, let's just forget about it. But when I looked at the photographs of myself growing up, I could not. It's like, there I was projected. There were slides, so I projected them onto my wall. And it was incredibly moving and sad. And that was, I needed to be faced with the evidence of what had happened to me. There is no kind of like paper trail, I say this in the book, about what happened, as for many people who have been assaulted. But I had the evidence of the aftermath, and that was very important.
You include a lot of photos in the book too, and I thought that was such a great, rich storytelling device. And speaking to what you just said, there are two photos at the very beginning, not the very beginning, but in the chapter about your experience of your grandfather sexually abusing you. And there are two photos of you before he started his abuse and then the year after. And you can see it in your eyes that there is something changed.
Yes. And I thought about whether I wanted to include photos of myself as a child, because I feel protective of that child. And I don't know, I thought about it a lot. And then I realized, no, I need to put those photos in, because you can see it. I saw it. And thank you for saying that you saw it too. But there's like an aging process or a something that has happened between before and after. And as much as we who have had this happen to us have been explicitly or implicitly told, do not tell, you know, there's tells like all over our faces, our bodies, the ways we are in the world. I think we can, you know, there's ways that we express what has happened.
Yeah. I don't want to dwell too much on the sexual abuse part of this book because it is so multifaceted. And so I don't want listeners to think, well, oh, this is just another story about sexual abuse.
Thank you.
Absolutely not. It's a couple of chapters and it comes up in other chapters, but it is just one part of your story. And this memoir is, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, right? There's so much that has happened to you that you write about. And so let's dive into a couple of them. I wrote down a couple of topics that I'd like to dig into a little bit more. And one of them is you have a, I was going to say unique immigration story, but I actually don't think it's that unique now that I check myself. You came to the US when you were 2 with your family, and your father is a doctor and came here for training, and then you didn't leave. Can you talk about your immigration status as a child and how that influenced how you saw the world?
Sure. So I didn't know that we were undocumented or out of, you know, administrative legal status until I was in high school. So the whole time when we were not in, you know, legal status, I was just blissfully unaware. I was dealing with other kinds of assimilation and, you know, microaggressions here and there, but mostly I was unaware. It wasn't forefront on my mind. I knew we were different. But then when I did the research for this book, I did a FOIA request on myself, got over 100 pages of documents from the government, and came across documents that said, first of all, undocumented doesn't describe literally what was happening, because the government knew where we were and they had like preparation for arrests for us actually by the time I was 9. And I know this because the documents say over and over again, subject is a 9-year-old child, and they would underline child a few times. And I think they did this because they wanted to remind the officers or whoever was going to, you know, follow out the policy or administer the policy and deport us. They wanted to remind them that we were a family and that I was a child. So I was just unaware of all that. And my parents were kind of unaware. When I showed them the documents, they were shocked. And they were like, oh, we didn't think it was going to be that bad. But I don't know. I think they were just kind of in denial. And that's how they deal with difficult stuff. So I was aware that being a so-called like illegal or illegal alien was a bad thing, and it was something that people made fun of. In junior high school, I know that I heard that a lot. They didn't know that I was a so-called illegal alien, but there was a lot of comments and about green cards and aliens and things like that. So in the atmosphere around me, I knew there was derision towards undocumented or so-called illegal alien people. And then, you know, and of course, in the midst of all this, like, well, I was one, you know, or I am one, and pretending not to be one. And so that was very difficult, that kind of pretending. I couldn't do it for that long. Eventually I did tell like a friend about it, but, you know, it was very, very uncomfortable to be around that kind of attitude, and also confusing, because it's like, well, everyone likes me, my high school friends like me, but then they're talking about other people this way, but then they don't know that I'm actually that. So what does that mean? It was just very, very confusing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also we had to lie, like we could not leave the country. And so when I would get invited to leave the country, I couldn't. And I had to make something up, which also I don't like to do, which didn't feel good. And I think on my parents' side, they probably didn't seek out help. I told them what had happened to me with my grandfather, I think when I was around 14 or 15. And, you know, we got help, like I got a therapist, but we didn't pursue the legal system or anything like that. I think they were still afraid. Even with my therapist, they warned me to and the therapist actually, to keep things confidential. And of course they do, but there was just this fear, like people are watching us, we can get deported. So that didn't help my mental health, you know, to have this fear of we could be deported if we do something that makes us stand out.
Mm. What year did you immigrate?
We came over in I think July 74, we were okay. here.
Okay. Yeah. So a different administration.
Yes. Reagan actually gave us relief.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that a lot of, you know, millennials and younger don't realize that immigration under a Republican presidency hasn't always been so hotly contested, but it was still, you still lived in fear every day.
A little bit, yeah, because we didn't have, there's like the no safety net. It's like, well, something might happen, and it's under the discretion or the kindness or the cruelty of whoever is going to decide to enforce or not enforce the policy.
Right.
And it was a bit kinder then. And I think now, I mean, this is why I think it's so important for immigrants, feminists, and other people to, like, for us to tell our own stories. If we don't, someone will tell a story about us for their purposes. And now that story is about immigrants. And there's a way that immigrants, mostly immigrants of color, have been blamed for all kinds of things. And there's no evidence that that's true. And yet it's very easy to construct a narrative about the other, in this case, immigrants, that were the problem. And we can do it to any group of people, but, you know, it's immigrants at this point. And that can bring in a lot of people under that umbrella of immigrants.
Right.
And then horrible policies can be enacted.
Yeah. I think it speaks to how important it is for us to diversify our bookshelves too.
Yeah.
But it's just, this isn't a book necessarily for other, you know, Filipina readers or Asian readers. This is a book for everybody because it's so important for, you know, as a white woman, for me to see stories about immigration, about sexual assault, about families and growing up and experiences from people and families that don't look like my own. We do share a connection that we both grew up Catholic. And so some of those things I recognized, but it was so important for me to read these stories. But why do you think it's important for us to read diversely?
Well, thank you for saying that. I've been nervous or wondering, like, will my book appeal to people who are not like Phil Am or immigrants or Asian American or something like that? And when I thought about it more, I just thought, why do I think that? Like, I didn't even come across a book by an Asian American author till I was in high school. So, and I've read all around, you know, all kinds of folks, and I love reading. So obviously, like, I could read and connect with so many kinds of stories and authors, but I just wasn't sure if other people would connect to my book. And you're right, there's a lot of topics that, and ideas and themes and things that I hope people can connect to and find themselves in, and maybe be surprised to find themselves in. And it maybe doesn't even have to do with identity, but rather how we feel about our mothers or fathers or family members or something, and they find themselves there, or how we feel as travelers, even if we never leave the country, just feeling strange or outside of communities or experience. So, you know, I'm really happy to hear that people would connect with the book, and I'm finding, you know, I've been on tour since March, and I'm winding down. This is like, I feel like I'm like rounding the curve at Harrisford Street and getting onto Boylston Street, if I use a Boston Marathon analogy. I do. I just feel like it's been a long book tour, but I've met so many people, and people who are not Filipino American or Asian American tell me that they do find themselves surprised. Like, they wouldn't have necessarily picked up the book, but someone put it in their hands and they were like pleasantly surprised. And I think it's important for them to have that experience, and maybe they'll pick up another book, and like my book will lead them to someone else's, which will lead them to someone else's. And then all of a sudden your bookshelf is really different and diverse. And it's not like an eating your vegetables kind of, or eating your fiber cereal kind of project, but rather one of pleasure and joy. Like, oh, let me try this. Let me try this one. And then that's more natural. And I think that it's important for us because we need to expand our notions of who deserves human rights, who's human, who's, I don't know, anything that can like pierce the narrative of like who is more human than others is what we need to do. And reading is such an intimate experience, and it will force you to do that.
That's why I love memoir.
Yeah.
It is my favorite genre. Yeah. And I'm so glad you said that, because I actually wrote down, this is, you know, just a note as you were speaking. It's the human experience, reading to recognize the humanity in others. Is there anything more noble than that? I don't think so. And one of the other ribbons that readers might connect with is your experience with preventative surgery for cancer.
Yes.
And so we don't have a whole lot of time left. Okay. And I wanted to, I've got some avenues I still want to go down, but sure. Can you tell me a little bit about your decision to have preventative surgeries?
So I have the BRCA hereditary breast and ovarian cancer mutation. I'm the first in my family to know, in my generation, to know about this. And it took me years, but I did a lot of talking, going to conferences, talking to doctors, talking to survivors, or previvors as we're called. And there was no other answer but for me to have these surgeries. If I didn't want to have cancer and spend a lot of my time and resources and worrying about, like, getting surveillance and wondering, is it cancer this time? I just couldn't do it. And it was the best decision. I don't think about losing my breasts. I don't think about losing my ovaries anymore. There's a freedom there. I was also in some ways afraid of, like, would I still be a woman? I don't know why I thought that, but, like, I just, in terms of my body, I thought, what does it mean for my gender identity? It means nothing about gender identity, I've learned. It has nothing to do with it. I don't know. It was hard, but I'm lucky. I'm not going to have cancer with a breast, ovarian and breast cancer. Maybe I'll get cancer from something else, but, you know, like, I did something, and that made me feel strong that I could do something with information. It was hard sometimes, but it was also an opportunity for people to be so kind to me, and, like, for me to learn about people and to learn that people are so generous and compassionate. And I mean, if anything good came out of it, it was that. It was like a corrective experience around my trust issues and letting people in. It really was. So I'm grateful that I could have those experiences.
Yeah. And you're safe now.
Yes.
I think that this experience, everything we've talked about so far, is all about the body, right? It's all about the stories that your body wears. And so, again, I think that The Body Papers is just a brilliant title. And one of the things I do want to talk about too is the last chapter you write. You begin the chapter with this: in the Philippines, I am an Americano, a returner, a Balikbayan. That is a Tagalog word probably that I don't know how to pronounce.
Balikbayan. You're Balikbayan. Fine.
Okay. I'm here to learn what it means to be Filipino, but somehow I've only become more American. And you're writing this, you know, having, you're spending 6 months in the Philippines as a returner. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what you mean by it, you've only become more American in that experience?
So in college, when my racial identity formation started to develop, I started to think of, like, ways of me belonging to Filipinos in the diaspora and to the Philippines, and to thinking about the Philippines as a homeland of sorts. And that was all fantasy and imagination and speculation and reading. And I didn't really get a chance to go to the Philippines. I would go maybe for, like, a few, like, 10 days at the most, but I didn't live there. I would just go and visit once every 10 years or so. And that's very different. That's being a tourist. And so when I got the chance to stay for 6 months, it was a deeper experience that showed me, I don't know anything. Like, what am I talking about? I'm American. People, if I think that I could fool myself, like, on a vacation for 10 days that I was Filipino and I was having a particular kind of experience, but to live there, to ride taxis, to walk around day in, day out for 6 months, no, people knew I was an American without me ever opening my mouth. It was the way I walked. I bought clothes in the Philippines. I got my hair done in the Philippines. I tried to fit in and pretend I was a Filipino, and it was not going to happen. Like, so, I mean, other people saw me as American, and then I started to understand how American I was, and that I actually didn't really have rights to it. I mean, I didn't grow up there. I grew up here. This harkens back to when we think of America, you know, maybe our notions are influenced by whiteness and thinking about like Americans as white. And even in when Filipinos and my parents and other folks talk about my American friends, they mean my white friends. And it's been this constant correction, like, no, you mean white, like not American, because I'm American. But it was totally, and in some ways it made me feel like finally I belonged in the US, is because I really felt it on a deep level. Like, no, the US is where it's home, is that's my homeland. That's where I feel comfortable. That's where, you know, where I feel free. The thing that I say every time I return from the Philippines is that I feel my freedom in a really big way. And some of it is freedom of movement. I walked around in the city. I took cabs. I moved all over the place in Manila, but here I just feel my freedom, and it's hard to describe, but it's like when you return to home and you can smell you're away for a while, and like you go back and you can smell like, oh, this is what my home smells like. I feel that when I come back to the US, is I'm very aware of my freedom in all kinds of ways. Economic freedom, my freedom of speech, freedom of movement, all kinds of things. I really do feel it.
Tell me a little bit about your writing life now. You're on tour, you're just wrapping up. What are you working on, and what's next for you?
Thank you. I'm working on essays. So the paperback edition of the book will be out next year. And I wrote an afterword. And once I started writing that essay, and the afterword is like, what was it like to publish my book? I started to finish and work on other essays. What I really want to be doing, or part of me wants to be working on, is a novel. I have like a lot of novels that are kind of half finished. And I also have a new novel idea that I've been researching, which is about Jewish refugees to the Philippines before World War II. So there's that. But at this point, I'm wrapping up the book tour, and I'm just trying to finish like a bunch of short essays for various things. And some are, some I've been working on for a long time, and they're around what I call my front seat to anti-Black racism in the United States. My husband is African-American from the South, and our experiences are so different. Even though I am also a person of color, I am an Asian-American, my privileges and way of being in the world is very different from his. And so I am trying to write it, list it, observe it, note it, be aware of it, and as a way of like not erasing, you know, we're not just all like people of color. Like, no, like some of us have more privileges than others. And it's sad in a lot of ways how much anti-Black racism is a part of his everyday life as soon as he walks out of our apartment.
Yeah. I can't wait to read that. I was so struck by there's a vignette in your book about him coming with you to the Philippines and how he feels like what white people must feel like all the time in the US, that he wasn't a Black guy necessarily in the Philippines. He was treated more like a celebrity, and he felt safer there. And so I'm very excited for that essay to come. I think that'll be excellent. We always ask at the end, if you have a book to recommend that's not your own that you would like our listeners to check out, what would that be?
I have it right up here. It's called Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger, edited by Lily Danziger.
Ooh, I love the title.
It is like, so in some ways it's cheating, because instead of just talking about one writer, you have, I think there's, you know, at least a dozen, there's maybe 15 writers who've contributed to this anthology about their expressing their anger. And there's writers like Kia Brown, Minda Honey, Lisa Factor, Tora Borchers, Meredith Toulousen, who is my cousin, on and on and on. It's like a great list of writers. And once you read their essays, then you can go on and read their other essays, or if they have books, to read their books. So Yes, Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger.
I love that. I will put that in the show notes for everybody. I'll put your work in the show notes as well. Where can people connect with you if they want to, if they want to connect online?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm on Instagram at Grace Tolusen Writer and at Twitter at GraceT09. I did it a long time ago, made that handle up. Anyways, GraceT09 on Twitter. And also email. Like, I love hearing from folks. If you don't want to do social media, you can email me at thebodypapers@gmail.com. And it's a huge gift to hear from you.
And check this book out, everyone. If you're a memoir reader, even if you're not a memoir reader, but especially if you're a memoir reader, this is brilliant. It is so immersive. You'll laugh, you'll cry. It is an excellent book. So make sure you check the show notes for a link to that. And thank you so much for joining me today. This has been such a delight.
Oh, thank you. This has been great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature, oh, 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 oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature,
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.